It's 1906 GMT from the BBC World Service. I am Peter Okwoche with Focus on Africa. Protesters and police have clashed again today on the streets of Cairo. At least 9 people are known to have died and over 300 more were injured as protesters continued their calls on the military authorities to step down. Demonstrators pelted security forces with rocks and petrol bombs as they fought running battles in the streets around Tahrir Square, the iconic focus of the protest movement that overthrew veteran President Hosni Mubarak in February. Smoke billowed over the square after two nearby government offices caught fire. These protests come as election officials are counting votes from the second round of parliamentary elections. Our reporter Rania Sabri told me more.
There have been more protests and more people joining the protesters down in the downtown area of Cairo. There's also a protest starting in Alexandria, that is the coastal city overlooking the Mediterranean. There is general attention, alertness among the people. I've heard a lot of people say it feels like January once again when people were fighting an authority that thought it was too strong. But so far, yes, more protests and more protesters. And also one more protester killed today after the 8 who lost their lives yesterday.
Just how widespread is the support for these protesters?
We cannot say that they are supported by the majority of the people. People are debating it, but every time you find only one person standing trying to explain to 5 or 6 that these people have a point, that they do feel that the revolution is incomplete. But no, they do not have support. People who are supporting them are supporting them with strength. They really believe in what they do and they have faith in their goals. But the majority of people, like I told you, are just fed up and want things to run normally. Of course, the fact that the first two rounds of elections have went so far smoothly is making everybody say that we were that close to democracy and now nobody knows what's going to happen next.
And have the authorities said anything at all about these latest protests?
Well, the Supreme Council of Armed Forces did issue a statement saying that basically they did not attack the protesters. It was simple as that. They did not offer any explanations for the video clips or for the images and the footage on thousands of cameras and thousands of TV stations showing army personnel or people in the uniform attacking protesters or hurling stones at them or beating them. The Advisory Council, which was just formed last week to aid the army in the transitional period, the majority of its members have suspended their membership. Some have resigned, and the head of the Advisory Council has actually given the ultimatum to the Supreme Council of Armed Forces before he himself resigns. As for the Prime Minister, Kamal El-Jenzouri, who was the main subject for all these protests because the protesters were objecting to his appointment, he did give a statement earlier, and this is what he had to say.
I address all the political forces and categories that Egypt is in your hands. What is happening in the street now is not a revolution, but it is a hijacking of the revolution.
So that's the newly appointed Egyptian Prime Minister, Kamal Jenzouri. And Rania, is it likely that these protests will continue?
At the moment, it is not clear, but the parliamentary elections, the second round of parliamentary elections, the results are expected shortly. And also there are reruns on next Wednesday and Thursday. So there are major events that need the matter to calm down for the time being. But it seems that nobody knows exactly what's going to happen.
Rania Sabri speaking to me from Cairo. Well, the event that triggered the revolts in North Africa, including Egypt, Algeria and Libya, and became known as the Arab Spring, actually began a year ago today in Tunisia. Thousands of people rallied there today to celebrate the first anniversary of the start of the uprising that toppled their long-standing dictator and unleashed the Arab Spring Revolution. sounds from the track, Mr. President. Your People Are Dying by the Tunisian rapper Balti, a song that popularly helped rally young people against the government. The Tunisian protest was sparked off in the southwestern town of Sidi Bouzid, where a roadside fruit seller's disagreement with a city inspector led him to set himself on fire. For more on today's event, I spoke to our reporter Sihem Hassaini in Tunis.
Well, the town of Sidi Bouzid has been preparing the celebration for several days. Today, thousands of people gathered in the town city. They came from all over, human rights activists, politicians, artists, and ordinary Tunisians to take part in the commemoration. There was a happy atmosphere with people singing songs about the revolution and its martyrs. The town was decked with Tunisian flags and pictures of those who died in the revolution, and a large picture of Mohamed Bouazizi. And the surprise of the day was the unveiling of a monument representing Bouazizi's cart.
How do people remember him?
Well, everything began in Sidi Bouzid. He was a young fruit and vegetable seller, 26 years old. He set fire to himself outside the governor's office after city inspectors confiscated his goods and allegedly slapped him. And his act prompted demonstrations the same day that grew into a protest movement across Tunisia against the Ben Ali regime. And Ben Ali fled the country on January 14th.
And why is today significant for those who are marking it?
First, today is an occasion to remember the martyrs who gave their lives for liberty. Second, Tunisia was the origin of a wave of revolutions across the Arab world. I spoke with Leila Bouazizi, a sister of Mohamed Bouazizi. She was very moved, and for her, today represents her brother's gesture against oppression. As she put it, when he burned himself, he burned with him the dictators in Tunisia and the Arab world's countries. She was also stressed that her family feels very proud but also sad with respect to all those who died.
And a year on, do Tunisians feel that their lives are better off?
In the days after the revolution, there was an explosion of freedom, above all freedom of expression. Tunisians that I speak with say that their lives have improved with this expansion of freedom, the end of dictatorship and democratic advances. But many also hope for their living standards to improve. There are many without jobs, and the new interim government has made fighting unemployment one of its priorities. And people are also eager to see figures from the old regime brought to justice.
That's Sihem Hassaini speaking to me from Tunis. You're listening to the BBC's Focus on Africa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the opposition candidate who had challenged President Joseph Kabila's re-election reacted last night's Supreme Court decision to reject claims of irregularities and confirm the incumbent's victory. The opposition is now calling for political discussions on the dispute as it still recognizes the veteran opponent Etienne Tshisekedi as the real winner of the presidential race. The BBC's Thomas Hubert reports from Kinshasa.
For Vital Kamerhe, Friday's Supreme Court ruling is just another violation of the electoral law. Speaking at a press conference in Kinshasa this Saturday, the presidential candidate who came third in official tallies showed what he said was evidence of systematic fraud. A pile of apparently authentic results sheets from voting stations with different results from those published by the Electoral Commission. And batches of up to 8 voters' cards displaying the photo of the same underage child. A fresh report by electoral observers, Congolese ones this time, said that the election's credibility was put in doubt by irregularities, including the discrepancies in the results listed by Mr. Kamerhe. He is now calling for political dialogue with the head of the Electoral Commission, Daniel Ngoy Mulunda.
Que la Commission nationale de médiation soit là.
Let the National Mediation Committee host it, with Mulunda and his experts. Etienne Tshisekedi, Kamai, who filed the complaint, and the international community can help. Then we start talking. We say, you cheated here, here, and here. Mulunda can reply, no, President Kabila didn't cheat. You're wrong. This is how things happened. Let us have this opportunity. It can defuse the crisis.
The Electoral Commission itself has called for international help in tallying the results of the parliamentary election, which are not complete yet. CENI officials have said that they would seek assistance from the UN peacekeeping mission in Congo. But the UN's deputy representative here replied that he had not yet received that request and that it would have to be considered carefully. Since the beginning of the Congolese electoral process, the UN has made every effort to avoid the type of direct involvement it had in Ivory Coast.
Thomas Hubert reporting from Kinshasa. You're listening to Focus on Africa on the BBC World Service with me, Peter Okwocha. It's coming up to 19:16 Greenwich Mean Time. Today's top African story, there's been a second day of violence in Egypt with protesters and the security forces fighting running battles in the center of Cairo. Elsewhere, Arab states are mounting a new effort to resolve months of violent upheaval in Syria. And coming up, we go live to Marseille, where the African Footballer of the Year, André Dédé Ayew, has received his trophy. We'll also be hearing about the life of a Cape Verdean music legend, Cesaria Evora, who has just passed away, and the tragedy of women accused of witchcraft.
Very often women who are alone, older, and have no real support in the community. They're marginal to everybody's lives, and they are very vulnerable.
You're listening to Focus on Africa on the BBC World Service. Now, it's big news in Marseille, southern France, where André Dédé Ayew has received the BBC African Footballer of the Year trophy for 2011. The Ghanaian footballer was chosen in an online vote and via SMS by fans across the globe. Dédé turns 22 today, and the trophy was handed to him in front of the fans at the Olympique Marseille Stadium just before their match against Lorient. The handover was done by his father, football legend Abedi Pele, who garnered the first BBC African Sport Personality of the Year award 2 decades ago. I'm now joined by the BBC's Farai Mungazi and Ibrahim Sani live from Olympique Marseille Stadium. Farai.
Thank you, Peter Okocha. And as we say, we are live here at the Stade Vélodrome, and that is the home of Olympique Marseille. And we are actually watching the Ligue 1 match between Marseille and Lorient. And we've had something like 62 minutes in the second half, and it's still goalless. This is a game that Marseille need to win because they are not they are about 9 points behind the leaders Montpellier in the French top flight. Well, the news as far as the BBC African Footballer of the Year, Dédé Ayew, is concerned, is that he is not playing because he is suspended. But his brother, Jordan, is playing. So far, no fireworks from him and his teammates. And as I mentioned, it's still goalless. But before the match started, as you said, Peter, André Ayew was presented with the BBC African Footballer of the Year trophy by his father, Abedi, who, of course, is a legend here in Marseille. And there was a huge cheer that went up around the stadium when Abedi Pele was introduced to the crowd. Because, Abedi played for Marseille and won the European Cup back with them in 1995. And he's somebody who's still very much revered in this part. And Ibrahim San is sitting next to me. It was wonderful to see the Marseille fans giving Abedi Pele and his son a huge cheer.
Yes, definitely. For the 4 years he spent here, he had such a wonderful time here, winning the only Champions League that France football has ever seen. So definitely, Abedi will remain a legend to the fans of Marseille. And his presence here, after being here for many years, means something to the fans.
And just another quick line as far as Dédé Ayew is concerned. We've just heard that he's extended his contract with Marseille until 2015 and has got a significant pay rise in the process. He also turned 22 today, so it's been a great weekend for the 22-year-old Ghana forward. And just before we hand back to you, Peter, just a quick word on Samuel Eto'o Ibrahim, because he was banned yesterday for 15 matches, and the news is that the Algerians are very happy with it.
Yes, definitely the Algerians are happy with the punishment meted out to Samuel Eto'o. Coach Vahid Halilhodžić has said that the punishment given to him merits the offense they did, but it is not known whether they will pursue that $1 million compensation they want from the Cameroonians.
Indeed, we shall see. And Peter Okocha, that's all from the Stade Vélodrome. It's a freezing night here in Marseille. And back to you in the studio.
Many thanks, Farai Mugazi and Ibrahim, live there from Marseille in southern France. Now, a woman was executed in Saudi Arabia this week for practicing sorcery and witchcraft. She was the second person to be executed in Saudi Arabia on sorcery charges this year. A Sudanese man was executed in the city of Medina in September. Accusations of witchcraft can lead to misery and sometimes death for those accused. 2 days ago, Congolese radio reported that a man in his 60s was beaten to death after being accused of practicing witchcraft near the eastern town of Butembo. Well, Jean Lafontaine is an emeritus professor of social anthropology at the London School of Economics. She has written a book on the subject, Speak of the Devil, in which she cites Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of Congo as two of the riskiest places for accusations of witchcraft. The BBC's Jenny Murray asked her why.
In particular, it's risky for children because they seem to have had what is nearly an epidemic of accusations against children that they are witches and are using witchcraft to harm people. And these children have been very, very badly treated and sometimes killed. But this is a recent phenomenon, and it appears to be bound up with the trials and tribulations that both those countries are going through. Or those parts of those countries are going through.
But why witchcraft? Why use that as an accusation?
Well, it's a way of explaining misfortune. Talk about bad luck, and we say, oh, it's such bad luck, this family always seems to be ill. In Africa, they would say it's witchcraft. And they might not necessarily try and pin it on any one person. They might just say it's the witches. But on the other hand, they might think of somebody they know wishes them harm and then pin that accusation on that person. So it is very much built into a philosophy of how people operate in the world and how some people prosper and others don't. It's a philosophy as much as a religious belief.
You've spent time in some parts of Africa where you've been able to talk to women who have been persecuted and accused of witchcraft. What sort of women have they been?
Very often women who are alone, who are older and have no real support in the community. They're marginal to everybody's lives, and they are very vulnerable to these sorts of accusations.
And what did they tell you about the lives that they lead now?
The women themselves will say they never did anything. I don't think there are many people in Africa who will admit to being witches. There are some children who say, who confess to it, but they only confess under duress, and sometimes this is very extreme.
But what impact has it had on the lives of the women that you've spoken to who have not been killed but have been persecuted?
I think there was a misunderstanding. I have not talked to many women who say they are witches or have accepted an accusation. I have talked to a lot of people who suspect witchcraft in their lives. You're more likely to find people who call themselves victims than who call themselves witches. And they are people who say this particular person has never liked them, this particular person competes with them for a job, or simply that this person is a bad person and likes doing this sort of thing. But it's a lot of witchcraft accusations is hearsay.
That's Jean Lafontaine, Professor of Social Anthropology at the London School of Economics. This is Focus on Africa on the BBC World Service. The world has lost today one of the most famous African musicians, the Cape Verdean Cesaria Evora. My colleague Zaneida Machado looks back at the life of an extraordinary woman.
Saudade, the Portuguese word to describe the feeling of missing someone. This word alone will not be able to describe the pain of millions of fans around the world after the death of Cesaria Évora, a mysterious, shy woman who went on a journey from a humble beginning in Cape Verde to international stardom. Even after she achieved fame and recognition, It was always to the beauty and culture of our native land that she turned for inspiration, as she explained in an interview with the BBC.
I have the same feelings any other Cape Verdean has. Cape Verdeans feel their music. We express ourselves through our music, through our mona.
Cesária Évora was born in 1941 in the township of Mindelo. People who know her say she was always quiet, but happy and full of joy. Her father played guitar and other instruments. He introduced her to the Cape Verdean rhythms. From a poor background, she started singing in local festivals and nightclubs with her women's group to raise money to help her family. She sang in the Mona style, a traditional nostalgic sound from Cape Verde, and remained faithful to it until the end of her career. After collaborating with well-known local singers, Cesária, or Cizé as most of her friends call her, went to Portugal in the 1970s, and then on to Paris, where at the age of 47 she recorded her first album, La Diva aux Pieds Nus, The Barefoot Diva, which was then how she came to be known. Audiences were impressed by her strong and at the same time tender voice and her unique style on stage. She would perform without shoes, seated on a chair, smoking tobacco and drinking alcohol. Cesária said that was her way of forgetting her hard life in Cape Verde. She was once asked why she decided to go to Paris. She smiled, smoked a cigarette, watched the smoke fading and responded, "I had nothing to lose." Cesária recorded a total of 10 studio albums, 4 of them had nominations for the Grammy Awards, and she won Cora All-African Music Awards in 3 categories. In 2005, her health began to deteriorate, but she managed to return to the studio to record Rogamar, which included a famous duet with Ismaelo, Africa Nossa. Africa, 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 Africa minha. Africa, 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 Africa minha, Africa nossa. Seu Jacques Lerien, consciência já desanuvia, já chegou a hora.
And a quick text here on the death of Cesária Évora. Daniel Garangtong in a Wales says, "Dear Peter, it's so sad to have lost our loved one. Mama Cesária Évora, may your soul rest in everlasting peace." Quick text here on the protest in Egypt. Anderson in Lagos says, "The army wants to hold on to power and they are continuing the regime of Mubarak. What a shame." Thank you very much for those text messages. Just before we go, another look at our top story. There's been a second day of violence in Egypt with protests and the security forces, protesters rather, and security forces fighting running battles in the center of Cairo. That's Focus on Africa for today. We leave you with the music of Cesária Évora, who's just passed on today. Africa don't bend around.